most interesting to the speakers, at least. Now they're going to get a response, and they'll get two-way communication with the audience. When I was asked to moderate this, I wondered what the function of a moderator was, and I finally came up with the idea that the function of a moderator to a group such as this is probably the same as the fan is to a fan dancer. His purpose is to draw attention to the subject, not to cover it. So you won't hear too much from me. I will simply be directing the questions.
Just don't drop your fan.
When the procedure in past groups has apparently been there has been a tendency that the group leaders have asked the questions, but anyone can and should ask questions if they so wish. There are two microphones put up, and we would ask that you would use them so that your questions will be recorded along with the rest of the program. The floor is open.
I have, at the beginning, some questions for Daniel Johnson that come from the group as a whole. Is that better? Okay, I have some questions for Daniel Johnson which come from my group as a whole. The first series relate to education. The first question would be, you talked about having a specialized kind of education that would not be paid for out of a land claim settlement. At least that was seemed to be our understanding. Our question is, if you have government funding, won't you have a certain amount of government control that's unavoidable as a result?
Well, the idea, yeah, you would. Okay, just to answer your question, if you had government funding, yes, there would be a certain amount of government control, but I think the thinking is to get away from controls put on by government and start moving towards controls that have been developed by people in the communities. And to give an example of that, one of the notions being discussed by Indian people in respect of, say, constitutional development of government here in the Yukon is the notion, I mean, we're not saying, this is not a policy position of the CYI, this is simply an idea that is being discussed. Or considered, let's say, and for future refinement. Now, for example, in the Yukon, we elect 12 people to government, and they in turn, well, to a council, and they in turn elect 3 people to a government, to an executive committee. And that is a very unsatisfactory arrangement, simply because the only input anyone ever gets into government is through the election process. But if people, well, say if the government of the Yukon Territory were to have a General Assembly, which is a model which many Indian organizations use, and that General Assembly was given the power to mandate policy to the government to establish direction for that government, then you have power going to the people. And you have representatives from every community, say, meeting 3 or 4 times a year and determining policy for any kind of development, for educational development, like policies. We're not talking about administrative details. We're talking about policy. Policies on education, policies on development, in terms of, okay, let's talk about this pipeline. You know, how much input have people had? People have talked and talked. But someone else writes that down and writes it, you know, and it gets down on paper and it just goes to government. Governments use it the way they want. And they make the, you know, so they determine policy. Whereas the idea that many people have is that people should be determining policy. So you can have policies determined by, well, on pipelines. You can have policies on hydroelectrical developments, on development of coal, on the extraction of minerals. And so our point of view, to get back to your question, is that, like, one of the policies that we have is Indian control of Indian education. And so we like to think there's money there already. Why not just let us have the power to determine how that money is to be used, and like, you know, what will the policies in education be, and have those policies determined by parents, because it's the choice of parents to send their children to whatever school they see fit. If they want to send their kids to a private school, then that's the prerogative of the parent. And if for example, an Indian community chooses to set up a private school, then it's the right and the privilege of that community to do so, and it's the right and the privilege of the parent to send their children to that school.
Well, that leads into the next question we had as a group, which is, would that then lead into a separation of the school systems, where there would be a native school system, and if so, where would teacher training and education and that sort of thing come from, if there was to be a separate native education program, or even if it wasn't separate, still, where is the training for people going to come from?
Well, the training for teachers has to come from determined by people in communities, and it also, but you know, like right now, it's being determined by government, by the Department of Education. Interest groups can have input, and they can lobby and give ideas to government, and government can pick up those ideas and use them. But what I'd like to do is address that part of your question that talks about separate systems. I think it's my personal view, and probably the view of many, that to completely go on a separate system would be a waste of a lot of time and a waste of a lot of money, because there are principles established already which can be used, principles which have been tried and tested, and which will approve themselves in the end. And I think what we would like to do is to have more control of education at the kindergarten and the elementary level. Well, you know, say from grades 1 to grade 3, where students can be taught bilingually, and can be taught the standards that are imposed at the national level, but at the same time retain local standards for relevant cultural type input. And so So, like, you know, there's a certain part which is separate, but that's not to say that it's bad. And there are also other parts which are already in place and which can be put to very good use, and hopefully can be changed to be of more use to students and to parents. And hopefully, in the end, the child who's receiving that education will be that much more better for the consideration that people and governments have for the education of that student.
Okay, I just have one more question, and it's for both speakers. The last question is, what about economic and social development of the disadvantaged people after land claims? How is the land claims going to affect Native people in the communities on an individual level?
Okay. What will the benefits of land claims be to communities at the local level, at the individual level, social and economic benefits? Right now, there are a lot of Indian communities which are pretty dependent on governments for continued existence. And the reason for that was the government relocated, like many Indian groups, into communities, which made it expedient for the government to handle, to administer, and that sort. But the government didn't finish its job. It didn't assume responsibility for the ramifications, the implications of what those relocations did, and what the imposition of another culture on Indian culture did. And so basically that's the next part of an explanation of like why a lot of Indian communities are dependent on governments. And so you have high unemployment, very little economic development, and in many communities, you can get into small business, but it takes a certain amount of awareness, it takes a certain amount of motivation, and it takes just plain moxie in some instances to get into business, because Indian people traditionally just haven't had that kind of experience. You know, it's to get into business is not, it's not something that Indians are familiar with because of their culture, but because of where they come from. But as a result of land claims, there are like many communities feel and wish to take advantage of opportunities to become self-sufficient. And the ways of doing that is by going into business. And in some communities, as for the Yukon as a whole, tourism is a good source of money. And so that's one of the areas, I think, which Indian people will capitalize on. And also just simply using the resources at hand, for example, the lakes, the mountains, the river valleys, Indian people could get into community or get into jobs which they can relate to because it gives them outdoor experience. Well, they have the outdoor experience, and the jobs are culturally relevant, where you could be taking people around on horseback, rides, photograph, horse rides, for people to take pictures, or else using tours on lakes or that type of thing. But it's up to the individual community, and I think a lot of communities recognize that you have to attain a certain amount of self-sufficiency, even if it may not be 100%, but the more the better. And the way to do that, it seems in this modern day and age, is to get into business. And Indians have a different view of business than a lot of white people. The free enterprise capitalist system, Indians aren't into that too much because that's not a part of their tradition. Whereas sharing in the resources of a community is a part of their tradition. And so what has happened in the past and what will probably happen in the future is that the Indian political body will own businesses for the good of its membership. And you can see that on the Navajo Reserve in the States. You can see that in southern parts of Canada, and you can see that kind of an idea being very comfortable to the Indian people here in the Yukon. And so, you know, basically business and getting into and making money so that you know, that you don't have to rely on wealth, or you don't have to rely on make work programs which governments have to put out. You know, it's not easy, you know, like you know, when you're in a small community where you're, you know, and your resources are very limited, to be able to be self-sufficient. But that is the aim of Indian people with this land claims.
I don't think I'd add very much to that, except to say that I think we have to remember that some of the most fundamental rights that we take for granted, the right to develop our towns, our school boards, and so on, are not available to Native people. Or if they are available, they're available in the most inappropriate ways. In other words, they have to become, in order to have some of the basic rights that we have, Native people have to become like us. They have to start to think like us. They have to become competitive like us, aggressive like us. In other words, they have to adapt themselves to our system. Whereas I would hope that with a land claim, that they would be able to develop their own system, their own economy, that would be appropriate to their values and to their culture and to their lifestyle. And I think one of the reasons why I hear so many white people say, well, you know, look, we've given them everything, and they still don't know how to use it, is because we have imposed on them our values and our way of doing things. And I think we have to remember that in a land claim, or hopefully in a land claim, that it will be no longer us saying, you know, here's a program, here's a school board, here's an educational system, here's some welfare, but that the Native people will develop those things in their own way and in their own time. An example of that is outside the Yukon, in the Nass River Valley, where the Nisga'a people live. They persuaded, after many, many years, they persuaded the government to allow them to form their own school district in the area where they are in a majority. And in 2 years, there's been an absolutely incredible change. 2 years ago, they had four of the most run-down schools. They had the kind of teachers that couldn't get jobs anywhere else in Canada. They roofs leaked, there was no equipment, there were no books, there was about a 98% dropout. In 2 years, they have four new schools. They have some of the best teachers in British Columbia. Last year, the first year there was a graduating class, 65% of the people graduated, whereas the previous year, 98% had quit. They have got their own, written out their own language for the first time in their history. They have started a bilingual program where grades 1, 2, and 3 are being taught, mathematics is being taught in Nisga'a, and eventually they hope that all 12 grades will be taught in Nisga'a by Nisga'a teachers. That's only happened in 2 years. It can be done when you give people control. But when you want to keep control back in our hands, which is the way our governments insist on doing things, we'll give you money, but we're going to tell you how to spend it. Or we'll give you money and in such a way that it's hopeless for you to succeed. And that's still perpetuating the old way. But I think you give people control, and they make it or break it on their own. It's their victory or their loss.
Yes, Mr. McCollum, I'd like to just address that question a bit further. In the Nisga'a experience of 2 years, do you see that perhaps they're overemphasizing Native culture and what have you, as opposed to the teaching of a Canadian way of life, or preparing Native children for a greater involvement in a Canadian society or a Canadian context? Is there a chance that there's an overreaction and too narrow an approach being taken in that situation?
Well, I suppose there's always that danger, but I think that when there was the even greater danger that anybody under the age of about 45 couldn't speak their own language, that there needed to be immediate steps taken to recover that language. I think when only the very oldest people remembered the spiritual and cultural roots of their people, that there had to be very instant, very immediate remedial action, or it would be lost forever. I think the I don't think there's that danger unless you come at it from the philosophy that assimilation or integration of Native people into white society is the philosophy you wish to follow. I don't think that Canada can be anything but enriched by having Native people whose roots are very deep and very strong and very clear. And if we fear that, then you know there's no doubt but what this country will fly apart, because we can't impose on so many people the kind of values and systemic ways of doing things as we have. And I think that's one of the reasons that our country is in danger of flying apart, because we have tried to make everyone the same. So to answer your question shortly, I don't think there's any danger.
On behalf of the group, we expressed a pessimism that perhaps racism was a word that was overstated. We're wondering, why do you think Europeans really colonized Canada? Do not economic reasons seem to answer more than racism? Is racism not a word describing little or no economic value of a particular group? Could we have your comments on that?
I'm not sure I completely understand the question, but I think that in our economic system, that there are, with its emphasis on competition, its emphasis on the survival of the fittest or the strongest, with its emphasis on nowadays on technology, and with the emphasis on skills which are totally foreign to Native people, that there was no chance for them to meet equally with the people who first arrived in this country. And there's no doubt that economic reasons were behind that. But I still don't think that changes the fact that the whole emphasis was racist. Because racism, as I understand it, means that one group or one race or one culture feels itself to be superior, so superior to the other, that the other's values and beliefs and so on are of little or no importance. And whether the reasons were economic or whether the reasons were religious or whether the reasons were any other, and those were two of the major reasons, I still think that it was racist. And I think we I don't think we have to start calling it by its right name.
Yes, this would be a question for either of the panelists. Are land claims really a decolonization of the Indian people while we have the present federal government control of all Yukoners? Should not decolonization, if land claims are in effect styled as such, involve all Yukoners, both native and non-native?
Well, from the discussion that many Indian people have, one of the elements which I talked about earlier was the notion, the idea that the land claims is not just a land claims, well, it will not just affect Indian people alone, but that it will affect all Yukoners, and that one of the considerations which Indian people have in respect of the present government system is to get more input and more meaningful say in that system. And so it does not necessarily mean that the present system, which is in existence right now, will be the system which is in place after the land claims. Because in attempting to negotiate a certain types of controls in different areas of, you know, in different areas which governments are presently involved, for example, the federal government is involved in fisheries, territorial government is involved in education and game, that kind of thing, that we would like to cause some changes to take place in that government. So what, in a sense, we'd like to do is to enhance constitutional development of the territorial government here in the Yukon through our land claims process, so that we can have more input for everyone here in the Yukon.
Leads into my next question, and I think you've anticipated it. Is there any other way Native peoples can achieve economic and cultural self-determination without simply drawing boundaries and dividing land in geographic areas, land claims in a narrow sense? Are there not alternatives such as veto powers respecting taxation or education in the legislative bodies, both Ottawa or Whitehorse, that sort of thing? Have you looked at a wider sort of negotiation than just a geographical definition of lands, especially respecting veto powers in the legislation, constitutional development, that sort of thing?
Well, you know, when you know, because people tend to become complacent, people tend to look at the activities of government with a certain amount of futility, it becomes difficult to provide alternatives as to how governments can do things. And so we have two ways, there are two ways of approaching this matter of constitutional development. One is to look at the system the way it is now and to attempt to improve on the structures that are in place and in governments as they stand now. There are, you know, ways in which you can get input, and that is, you know, for example, where you can negotiate input at least, or negotiate control, and that's, you know, by getting on say committees, advisory boards, tribunals, or just by getting into government through the elected process. And also, like the other way is to provide alternative forms of government, or say you could call them radical modifications of government. You know, for example, the concept of a general assembly might not be such a bad idea. It slows the decision-making process down, but at least you have input from a lot of people, you know. And so in that way you bring power back to the people, and you bring the control of resources, the control of developments back to the people. You know, like for example, this pipeline, it's been just ramrodded right past us, you know, right, but there is no rush, you know. What the hell is the rush? You know, yeah, because the Americans need the gas. Canada jumps and just says, yeah, where do you want it? So, but, you know, we could take another 2 years and people, you know, we could discuss these things in general assemblies and make policies. You know, we could make policies on single regulatory agencies. We could make policies about timing and make policies for that energy corridor, those kinds of things.
Presentation on in present structures such as our Yukon Legislative Assembly as an acceptable constitutional development, or would you foresee any wider type of assembly? You mentioned a general assembly.
Well, it's a really difficult question to ask because, I mean, you know, basically there's two points of view. There's the the British parliamentary system, which has been introduced to this country, you know, and here in particular in the Yukon, where we have a small colonial government, which the federal government completely controls. And the federal government can put the squeeze on this little council anytime it wants, and this little council is going to say, ouch. And, you know, it just happened the other day. Art Pearson said, the commissioner or the minister has stated that the motion being proposed for the council to have the power to strike inquiries is an erosion of the powers of the commissioner, and therefore we will not grant you assent. Just like that, pinch, and all the territorial government can say is, that's disgusting. But it's a sad fact, and it's true. Okay, and so the other point of view is the way Indian people view decision-making, where decision-making is done largely by consensus, people agreeing on something. And this is the traditional way of doing it, and it's still happening, although it's not a pure form of consensus, because we've adopted, you know, the certain rules of order. You make motions, and you have a seconder, and then you have a, you know, you discuss it, and you have a vote. But it's a large assembly, and it's a form of consensus. So the idea then is to bring the theses and the antitheses together and make a synthesis. Now, what is that synthesis going to look like? And that's a very difficult question to answer.
Probably my final question, what happens after tonight vis-a-vis the non-native participation in land claims? Is this it for the non-native population? Does anyone on the panel see any way in which we can support or participate in native land claims? I believe Mr. McCollum was developing that idea that
In Northwest Territories, there is a group of non-native people, primarily in Yellowknife, who have formed themselves into a group called Alternatives North. And they see themselves as studying and trying to understand the land claims, to participate in terms of educating other non-native people, holding forums, and generally acting as a support group to the Indian people who are trying to negotiate their land claims. I think that Rob Hornsey is planning to have a meeting here on tomorrow afternoon at 2:30 at where his office is. What's the name of the? To talk about the possibility of doing something here, and I would, I think it's a very good idea. There are 26 non-native support groups across Canada who are interested in the land claims of the Yukon Indian people and other northern native organizations, and they have they are also in touch with the northern support groups, so that there can be a network of information sharing across Canada and across the North, that would, I think, help to do more to break down the misconceptions and misrepresentations and apprehensions and fears of people. If the non-native population were engaged in that attempt to understand the situation, and I'm sure that the Indian people would welcome that and would be prepared to share information and resources with
Is there a support group in Yukon?
Not in any formal sense that I know of, but I think there should be.
Thank you very much.
I'd like to turn the attention from the territorial perspective to the community perspective and ask a question of the panelists in relation to the ways in which some of these suggestions that have been put forward would be realized in communities. Can you outline or touch upon, Daniel, some of the models that, and if you'd like to use education as a specific example, although I think our group sort of felt that it might apply with equal facility to local government or economic development. Can you sort of describe some of the models that are being considered as being applicable in relation to controls and the process that realizes those kinds of programs and implementation of those programs you described?
Okay. Well, okay. Maybe first what I'll start with is the powers that communities, well, certain portions of many communities already have. Like the bands who are registered with the Indian Affairs Department and who fall under the Act, the Indian Act, have certain powers to make bylaws on their lands in respect of a number of things. So like they, you know, they already have a certain amount of jurisdiction on reserve lands. And so given that power that's already there, it would be, first off, it would be foolish to ask the Indian people to give that up, because there's not much of a chance. I mean, there's got to be a pretty good exchange. I mean, the government's got to really come out with something that the Indian people like, for them to let go of that kind of power. And this power we already have under the Indian Act. Rather, what we would like to see is a development, a consolidation, and an entrenchment of that kind of power. And see, what it does is it gives the community a certain amount of decision-making. It just makes decision-making available to people, and when people get together to make decisions, they usually make better decisions than if someone made that decision for them. And so what the progress of like many communities is now is that there are community councils formed, which are an amalgamation of status and non-status memberships, and this community council represents their communities in land claims matters primarily at this time, but in the future will probably represent become virtually like the local government of that community. It's very similar to municipal type structures, and though, like that community would make decisions for business, getting into business, investing, would make decisions in respect of social and cultural needs of their community, and that community would have the power to develop policies in terms of, say, education of their children.
I'm faced with a dilemma of in which order to ask the next questions. Specifically, this relates to selected communities in the Yukon. We envisioned that there would be many communities in which that kind of model wouldn't pose difficulties. And in fact, it is in practice, in part, in some settlements. But we turned our attention to those communities in which there are distinct differences and they are segmented communities. Is there a mechanism or some attempt to draw those segments together so that what happens in the community accounts or accommodates different aspirations, different basic underlying philosophies in achieving your end? I can suggest it practically. You don't end up with two skating rinks and two whatever else, or that may be the route to go. The question I really have to pose is what happens in mixed communities in terms of the models that you're proposing?
Well, just maybe to start off answering that question, I think one of the things that Indian people have always been toward white men is very accommodating. And I really marvel at the patience of Indian people when they see this different looking person come into their land and you know, assume superiority, begin assuming ownership. You know, where the Indian person has always helped the white people to survive here. We were really, you know, like, we were friendly, eh? We're friendly people. Help you out, no problem. It's like remedial tutoring, you know. White person comes into the community or the Yukon in the old days. Well, he's a little slow learner, you know, so you got to get on his case and help him out a bit. And that's what we've done in many, many cases, many instances. And, you know, so we've been accommodating. We respect the differences. If, you know, even if we don't understand, you know, what the differences or the nature of those differences are, at least, you know, we don't get heavy about it. And so the only thing I could think about that, and to answer your question, Bob, is that if we have a system in our community, and that system may be different from community to community, I think it's our duty and our responsibility to respect the differences of our neighbor, and to let them evolve in their own way, and they're at their own stage of development. And if, you know, in mixed communities, they're just, people just have to work out the differences. And I certainly hope that, you know, these kinds of differences don't result in people taking negative actions. And I certainly wish for the mental and attitudinal development of all people. And I hope, as Indian people, in our attempts to grow in this land, in this day and age, this time, that you know, what we try will be for the benefit of all.
Maybe I can then pose the next question, which I can probably best pose as by way of illustration. In some schools throughout the Yukon, there are Indian language programs, and they are, by and large, provided as options for children to take. In many of those cases, the children taking those Indian language programs and language classes are non-Indian children. We were concerned in our group that if the mechanism that led to, I hesitate to use institutionalization of Indian language programs, meant that only one segment of the society, the Indian segment, could partake in that, then we would, in a sense, be defeating part of the thing that Mr. McCallum was getting at, and that is increased sensitivity. It's been my observation that the non-Indian kids that take those programs come away with a much broader view of cultural differences and biculturalism. Do you see the question? The question centers around, will there be an exclusive component so that non-native people won't be allowed to participate in that? And if so, do you envision those kinds of problems of, well, that you spent the better part of the panel describing, being encouraged to continue as opposed to altering their character?
I think not. From my own experience in sort of bicultural education, not, you know, I'm not saying that I teach biculturally, but from my observations of students who are experiencing bicultural type education, that what results is exactly what you described in your little scenario, is that the non-Indian kids begin to develop a better understanding and a feeling for who that Indian child is and what his background experiences are. For example, up in Destruction Bay, the school there, there are certain things being done to show, for example, the non-Indian portion of the class, what Indian people do. And so they go out in the bush and they learn to make fires, and they learn to trap gophers, set snares for rabbits, and that kind of thing. And the Indian kids feel great because they're comfortable, they're at home there, they know how to make fire, they know what kind of wood to get, they know how to set the traps for gophers, they know how to set snares for rabbits. And you know, the white kids use a little remedial tutoring there, and they really, you know, they appreciate the difference. They develop a feeling for who that and what that Indian child's background is. And so, to me, to my mind, it, you know, that helps bring people together, you know. And but to address your question directly, I certainly hope that there is, I mean, I don't foresee it anyway, that the types of education we would like to have for our children, we would like to see them open to everybody. You know, like, okay, if we had a college here in the Yukon, and much of the emphasis had to do with Indian culture, let's say, I would shudder to think that the membership at that college would be closed only to Indian people. I mean, you know, closed to white people, let's say. I would shudder to think that. I would think that would be regressing. And, you know, I think we just have to learn to respect each other's differences and learn from that way, and learn to appreciate each other by doing that.
Back to an earlier point you may have touched on, and that is the character and the process and whatever evolves in communities for their form of controls in different areas of programs or different areas of community control. Do you envision that the kind of guideline or baseline rules that you mentioned were already banned council rules? Do you envision that those rules would be the same for all communities, or would they adjust from one community to the next, keeping in mind differences in communities?
Well, I would suspect, like, the, say, the political nature of controls in various communities would be different, and, you know, simply because all communities are unique and have their own special and peculiar type problems and situations. But I think the concept, like the principal concepts of sharing, of community ownership of business and that kind of thing, are, you know, run as a theme through all of the communities.
The last question put forward was one in relation to the different basic philosophies, and another illustration is if a community asks for one community television, and a government agency, whatever it might be, says, no, I'm afraid you can't have one community television, but you can have television for all people in the community, showing the differences between cooperative as opposed to individual interaction with both communities and government agencies. We were faced with a dilemma where many of these problems of what we would call, or what we might call, important services or essential services, viewed from one perspective, may be quite different from another. And we weren't sure whether necessary services are always necessary to both groups and mixed communities. And we weren't sure to the extent in which they're reconcilable. And maybe both the panelists could address this kind of question. I appreciate it's nebulous, but...
Well, I just don't know how to answer that. Just have to be honest with you. All I can say is that that will be the test of the community that tries something like that.
I don't think I understand the question well enough to answer it either.
Have we any individual questioners? No one else?
I'm directing this question to Hugh, and it's in relation to the process of negotiations and land claims, and specifically the precedent that the government has relied on to date on James Bay. And don't you, I would like your comment on this, not saying that I feel strongly on this point, but don't you think that the situation as it is shaping up in the Yukon looks very, very much like James Bay all over again?
I think a lot of the elements are there. Although the land claims have been underway before the pipeline decision was made, Yukon people are now faced with pipeline construction in 1981, January of 1981 or thereabouts. Even if they are able to present an agreement in principle and negotiate a final agreement, it seems ludicrous to me to expect that the achievements of that land claim, whatever they may be, could be in place and working in time to deal with a project of the enormity of this of the Alaska Highway Pipeline project. So that, in a sense, it is still being forced to negotiate with a gun to your head in the face of enormous really unplanned and unstudied projects. And so they, I think clearly the Native people are up against the wall because of this pipeline project, and it bears very many similarities to the James Bay situation.
That answer to that question, I'd like to further point on self-determination. In comparison with your experience of having been in the Northwest Territories and in the Yukon to a certain extent, having almost been born here, what I'd like to talk about is that to what degree, like when you speak of self-determination, you would like it to be a whole thing, you know, like done economically, politically, throughout the whole segment of the society that is attempting to attain the goal of self-determination. Do you not see vast differences in between the Northwest Territories and the Yukon in terms of not only that they have a majority, but in terms of the political realities of Indian people in those two territories?
Oh yeah, I think there are a great many fundamental differences, and one is the degree of contact with the dominant society. Another is the population difference, the demographics. But I think self-determination has to take different faces in different places, and the aspirations of the Dene and Inuit in trying to establish separate territorial or regional governments is probably not feasible in the same way in the Yukon. But self-determination anywhere should not depend on whether you are in a majority or a minority position. It should depend on the right of those people for historical and political reasons. It depends on the right of those people to have some say in determining the direction in which their lives will take based on their cultural and political and economic values, and based on some basic justice because of their historical position. So I think that the form that it will take will of necessity be different between the Yukon and the Northwest Territories. But the principle of the right of the Native people to control and determine their own future is the same, whether it be here or whether it be there.
Okay, then as you look at the whole picture, you'll agree with me that the Yukon Indian people will have settlement before the Northwest Territories people. Would you not agree with me? That it looks that way, you know, like...
You sound like a lawyer. They always use that, you will agree with me, but... I'd be very hesitant to predict on a timeline. It seems, because of the imminent Alaska Highway Pipeline project, because of the length of time that the Yukon has been in some form of land claim discussions, and because of the demands for more fundamental change in the political structures that the Inuit and Dene are asking for, that probably the negotiations will take much longer and perhaps be, I was going to say more frustrating, but I don't think they could be much more frustrating than they are here.
Then taking into consideration the government's approach to the Yukon situation, where they're very more or less favorable in terms of the political releases of their statements and return statements to Yukon Indian position, is saying that, okay, we're going to settle with you. We like the idea of your amalgamated approach to the whole problem, one settlement for all people. And the differences of what they're asking. On one hand, the Dene are asking for total control and of a geographical area. They're asking for their own government, you know, that to really be able to be self-determination in a true sense. Whereas in the Yukon, most people are talking in confines of one government system, and there seems to be already a lot of trade-offs being made in a lot of areas. And okay, the question is, do you think that the eventual settlement of the Yukon land claims will compromise the Dene position?
I don't even know whether I should try that one or not. I think that the... I'll put it another way. I'll answer it perhaps in a less specific way, because I really don't feel I have the right to, you know, I don't know enough about the Yukon position to comment fully on that. I think the position of all the Indian people in the North has already been compromised by the James Bay Agreement. And that is insofar as the federal government is concerned. I think that it is clearly modeled on the old treaties, albeit the terms and conditions may be somewhat more generous. It's modeled on the extinguishment of Aboriginal rights. It's modeled on the extinguishment of true political control, regardless of the demographics. It's the precedent-setting land claim. I think the fact that the Cree and Inuit of James Bay were forced to negotiate under pressure indicates that the federal government is probably never serious about settling land claims unless there is an imminent resource development project in the wings. I think that is a very unjust way of doing things, a very unfair way of doing things, but it seems to be the reality with which we have to live. So whether the Northwest Territories land claim position will be compromised by any other land claims that are, and there are others that are even more, they're even closer to settlement. The Cope land claim is almost completed, I understand, and the Métis are about to start their land claim negotiations in the next week or so. So I don't think I could comment on whether they will be any further compromised than what has already happened from the James Bay model.
Any more questions?
I'd like to address my question to Daniel Johnson concerning the implementation of the native curriculum that you described briefly. My question is, does this implementation depend upon the settlement of the land claims, or are you now trying to negotiate with the Board of Education?
Both. There is work being done largely by Mary Easterson, education consultant to the Yukon Native Brotherhood, to to influence policies and decisions made in the present system, and also there will be, I guess, conditions or policies or that of the like negotiated and trying to be achieved, like principles, understandings, trying to be arrived at through the land claims. So there is work being done now, although we're in a relatively powerless position. The only way to get power is to, at this point, and in respect of the education system, is to get on school committees and that sort.
Yet?
On curriculum development?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I haven't myself. I think Mary Easterson has, and I think in the Yukon Native Brotherhood's department, the education department, they have a certain amount of curriculum development taking place, but very little, very, very small work. You know, there's no work being done, like there's no curriculum development being done where, for example, say Kaska Athabaskan is studied, there's an alphabet developed for it, there's a course outline developed for it, you know, so that the teacher has his materials and he has his students and he can use his course to teach. You know, there's no course outlines, no hard and fast developed curricula or material, you know, for that kind of thing.
So it's basically an undeveloped approach at the moment.
Well, it's undeveloped in the sense that we have very few concessions from the Department of Education at this time. It is more developed in that there is some private work being done on the development of languages. Just the basic research needed in order to develop an alphabet for language, and to, you know, make, say, noun dictionaries and the like. A lot of preliminary work being done in that area, but I don't think it's being encouraged by the Department of Education here in the Yukon. And one of the things that could be done by this Department of Education is, you know, to have a certain amount of its budget allocated for people who want to submit proposals for grants to do language research and to do curriculum development at the, you know, that is relevant to the local level, to the community.
Any more?
I've been in the Yukon for around 25 years. Some of the old timers told me about what terrible hard times they had before the white man came, and they regard the coming of the white man as a wonderful thing. And the only thing that has spoiled the situation is we've had some white people come into this country with the idea of making themselves their second million and then getting out. And that's left the Indians in a kind of a bad way.
Mr. Armstrong, have you got a question for the speakers? This is question period.
Well, I would like to point out that Kathy Van Bibber told us over CBC just recently that she believed the Indians should be making use of the opportunities that the government has already given them for economic development. And when I first came in here, there wasn't such a thing as welfare. Now they're getting their welfare checked as a good living, and there's no reason why they can't invest their time in economic development.
Okay, now let's have a question for Mr. Johnson or Mr. McCullough.
Well, Mr. McCallum has been talking a great deal about the rights, but he hasn't put any emphasis on the responsibility of the Indians as citizens. And that's what's causing the trouble. And that's why he is an Anglican and is causing a lot of trouble. And I've been arguing this point for the last 25 years.
Okay, what's your question to this Anglican?
What have they done in 25 years except stir up trouble?
Would you like to?
Oh, I wrote a couple of books and stirred up a little more trouble.
Okay. Is that it? Garth asked me to wrap everything up, and this is the last of the sessions, so I'll do that. First, thanks to tonight's participants, Daniel and Hugh. Thank you to the speakers of previous weeks, and thanks especially to the audience tonight and for the past 3 weeks, because without the audience, there wouldn't have been any show. I think this has been a learning process, and perhaps I could leave you with a favorite quotation of mine. In every man I am his pupil, for as a bee collects nectar from each flower, I learn from each man with whom I come in contact. Good night, and take care.